From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Former House Majority Leader and outspoken conservative Republican Dick Armey is known for his politics, less government, lower taxes, no minimum wage, and for his political axioms. Tonight on Point, Dick Armey looks with us at the current administration and explains why macho hurts and no man can ever lose his daddy spurs. But first, James Baker met today with Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder of Germany and President Jacques Chirac of France and received commitments from both leaders to help reduce Iraq's estimated $120 billion debt. President Bush sent his father's Secretary of State to Europe as a special envoy for Iraqi debt reduction. Sunny Ephraim is State Department correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. I asked her to describe how James Baker has been received in Europe.
Much better than expected. In fact, this evening, the three countries, France, Germany, and the United States, signed a joint communique pledging to work together to achieve, quote-unquote, substantial debt relief for Iraq. That's much more than anyone would have expected, particularly from two allies that have had very bitter rifts with the United States over the Iraq war so recently.
So what exactly does that mean? The devil is in the details often here. There are billions of dollars at stake. Are France and Germany really ready to step up and let a lot of that money owed to them by Baghdad go?
Well, the real question is how much. I think that, yes, France and Germany today clearly indicated a willingness to let some of that money go. Iraq's debt now to all the Western countries is estimated at about $120 billion. Of that, about $40 billion is owed to the Paris Club, which is a creditors organization that includes France, Germany, and Russia. Germany alone is owed more than $5 billion. Now, Germany's statement was very positive tonight. Gerhard Schroeder is clearly bending over backwards to make amends with Washington, even though the Germans are quite upset at the recent decision by the Bush administration to bar German contractors from even bidding on any of the reconstruction contracts for Iraq. Nevertheless, the German government released a statement saying that not only was it ready to reschedule the debt, but it was also ready for substantial debt relief for Iraq. But you're right, the devil is in the details. One of the big details is that the Paris Club traditionally has made all its decisions unanimously. I believe there are something like 30 members of the Paris Club, and one of them is Russia. Russia has been quite hostile to the idea of writing off the debt. I think they've agreed that rescheduling the debt would be acceptable, but they say that Iraq is a wealthy country with lots of oil resources, and they're not prepared to write it off.
And both France and Germany said today that they want to do whatever debt reduction or forgiveness there is in the context of the Paris Club, this group of countries that have been around since 1956, dealing with obligations of over-indebted countries. Sunny Ephraim, what has James Baker's leverage been with France and Germany? After all, as you say, Washington just said last week they'll have no part in the $18.6 billion in contracts that are doled out for reconstruction in Iraq. What leverage has Jim Baker brought to Europe to get them to make these concessions on Iraqi debt?
Well, that's a really good question, and I think probably the answer is his own personality. Baker is enormously respected in Europe. He's seen as the architect of the person who put together the coalition in the first war. More importantly, he's seen as the man who has the ear of President Bush. Senator Joseph Biden said to me today, you know, Colin Powell is very, very respected and very well-liked, even loved by the Europeans, but there's a sense that when he comes home, he gets kneecapped. Baker, when he comes home, the Europeans think will go straight to the president, and he's an old friend of the Bush family and an old troubleshooter. As you recall, he was a troubleshooter for the Bush campaign. And the perception, anyway, in Europe is that Baker will run right back into the president's office and President Bush will do what Baker recommends.
But does that really make him more welcome in Europe? After all, President Bush has bitterly and personally at this point feuded with both Jacques Chirac and Gerhard Schroeder. Why would they be so inclined to deal more generously with a close confidant of George Bush?
Well, there are increasing signs that the French and Germans, despite how bitter the rift was over the war and despite all the nasty words that were exchanged, really want to bury the hatchet and put things behind them. They want to find a way to cooperate with the Bush administration. There's some increasing indications that France and Germany see their own security at stake if Iraq were to fail. France has a very large population of Muslims, perhaps 10%, some people say even higher percentage of the population. And they're very worried about the radicalization of that domestic constituency and the potential for a failed Iraq state really being a black hole in the Middle East.
Do you have a sense of whether Jim Baker came with more threats or more incentives? I mean, is he the grand old man there to say, look, the world's going to fall apart if you guys don't climb on board? Or is he saying, climb on board and we may soften up on this $18.6 billion in contracts. You may have a piece of the pie.
Well, we don't know what Baker's saying in private. I think Baker is a supremely good diplomat, and he may well have both. But I certainly think he's going to be calling on old friendships and appealing to the national interest of the French and the Germans, saying, you don't want a disaster in Iraq. Failure in Iraq will be just as damaging for you as it will be for us.
Meanwhile, Colin Powell is hospitalized after surgery for prostate cancer. Jim Baker's out there making things happen. How does this reflect on the Secretary of State? Does it look like the old A-team is brought in to really get things done here? Does it reflect poorly on the Secretary of State?
Well, some people, Senator Biden among them, think that it is a humiliation for the Secretary of State. Others say that this is something that Baker is good at, that Powell cannot possibly do a job this big while acting as Secretary of State in the middle of a very, very busy diplomatic period, and that he's an old friend of Baker's as well. The two men have worked together well, and this is a really good thing to have a special envoy do because it consumes, you know, more than 100% of someone's time, and Powell simply can't give that much time. Also, the State Department's making a big point of showing how in touch and not sidelined Powell, in fact, is. Armitage, his deputy Richard Armitage, gave an interview this morning in which he said that Powell had already called him twice before 7 a.m. from his hospital bed. And certainly the image we're getting from the State Department is the secretary who's engaged, who's sending emails from the hospital, and who's very much still a player.
But old Jim Baker is cutting the deals, and maybe we have some debt forgiveness here, and maybe some binding of wounds between the U.S. and Europe. Sonny Ephraim, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Sonny Ephraim is State Department correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. She spoke with us from Washington. Dick Armey waved the flag for unapologetic conservatism during his 8 years as House Majority Leader. With Newt Gingrich, he co-authored The Contract with America, a collection of 10 culture-shifting bills introduced during the first 100 days of Congress in 1995. He fought to derail Hillary Clinton's health care initiative and to support Clarence Thomas's nomination to the Supreme Court. He is a longtime advocate of the flat tax and has lobbied to abolish the minimum wage. Tonight on Point, Dick Armey shares the lessons he learned in his 18 years representing North Dallas in the U.S. Congress and gives us his take on the Bush administration, the war in Iraq, and the upcoming presidential election. What do you make of the Texas voice to the right of George W. Bush? Are you ready for pearls of wisdom from Dick Armey? Do you agree with Armey's axiom number 21, liberals love feelings too much, conservatives love facts too much? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Dick Armey. He served in the House of Representatives for 18 years, the last eight as House Majority Leader. He was the ranking Republican on the Joint Economic Committee, chairman of the Republican Conference, and chairman of the Select Committee on Homeland Security. He's now co-chairman of Citizens for a Sound Economy, which promotes free markets and limited government. His new book is Armey's Axioms, 40 Hard-Earned Truths from Politics, Faith, and Life. Good evening and welcome, Dick Armey.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. Thanks for joining us tonight. Dick Armey, you say that this book was written primarily for the fun of it, and you hope it will be read for the same reason, and we will read in that spirit tonight, in part, but there's also a lot of serious stuff going on here. You have always been a guy for axioms, and you've got 40 of them here. If you want the divorce, you give up the house. Politics sooner or later makes a fool out of everyone. A man will fight like a cornered rat if his chicken manure is at stake. We kind of want to walk through what's going on in the world, look at it through Dick Armey's eyes and Dick Armey's axioms. Are you up for that, sir?
Well, we'll give it a try.
Okay. Good. Where should we dive in? I guess let's start with Iraq. It's been on everyone's mind in the last few days. You watched the capture of Saddam like the rest of us. But you put up some opposing ideas to the war in Iraq in August of 2002. One of the axioms in your book is macho hurts. Has the Bush administration been macho, too macho in going into Iraq? What do you think of the decision to go to war there?
Well, I worried about that a whole lot at the time, and I took an awful lot of briefing. I probably took more briefings on Iraq at the time that the decision was being made than any other member of Congress, since I was, I think it's fair to say, the most high-profile skeptic with respect to whether or not we wanted to or needed to, mm-hmm. to dive into that mess. And one of the things I worried about was, and talked to the president about, whether or not this was a case of what I like to call He-Man macho psychosis. And frankly, I became convinced that that was not the case, that in fact Iraq did pose a serious threat by virtue of its relationship with terrorist organizations, including Al-Qaeda and others. And finally, I became convinced that this was a necessary and an appropriate action. But I have to tell you, it was still the toughest decision I made while I was there, and I still always, every day, wake up worrying that, was it the right thing? Did we do the right thing? Was it indeed necessary? Every time you see these horrible reports about lost lives, especially yep. of our young people, you sit back and worry again, all over again about it.
Dick Harmy, when you raised your doubts in August of 2002, when the ramp-up was clearly beginning, in public at least, it wasn't a He-Man macho psychosis that you were worried about. You said, I don't believe that America will justifiably make an unprovoked attack on another nation. It would not be consistent with what we have been as a nation or what we should be as a nation. Have you changed your mind about preemptive warfare since August of 2002?
No, I haven't, and I'm still in a great deal of hot water with a lot of people because I have not changed my mind about that. It's a tough thing to ask us to do, but we've done it in the past, maybe never facing this, what should I say, obvious an impact as we had with the Twin Towers, since we've rarely had a case where we were attacked on our own soil. But it still, it strikes me that that's who we are. We're not a nation that wages war against other people.
But of course, we have made it waged war against other people, but you're saying not without a clear provocation.
Not without a
provocation.
Clear provocation and not as people who initiate the adventure.
On the other side of it, there's an axiom in your book, one of the 40, number 6, that George W. Bush might pull out and wave under your nose, Dick Harmy. You write, if you love peace more than freedom, you lose. Is Dick Harmy vulnerable to this axiom on the Iraq war front?
No, I don't think so. In fact, it is indeed freedom that I found so precious. I remember being in the White House and citing Shakespeare, our doubts make us traitors. I forget the exact quote, but it is, in fact, our freedom, our cherished liberties that caused me to be so cautious about being involved in this. Because, again, we take a look at, for example, the implementation of the Patriot Act and so forth. As we get involved in this in the past, we have betrayed our devotion to liberty, the way we treated Japanese Americans, for example, in World War II. And so I would say it was exactly out of a commitment to freedom and liberties that caused me to be the foot dragger there.
Has it made you feel odd, Dick Harmy, given your political history, to find yourself, you know, riding in the same car here as the ACLU on some days, as some very prominent liberals, maybe a bit as Howard Dean?
With respect to my reservations, yes, I remember being the object of much affection by Dennis Kucinich during those times when I was speaking up. It was not, of course, a position that I was accustomed to having what felt like during times there. I had more friends on the Democrat side of the aisle than I did the Republican side of the aisle.
All of a sudden, for a little while.
For a little while, until I suppose I finally came to the conclusion that, yes, this was an appropriate and a necessary position for us to take. It was, like I say, it was never an easy position for me to come to, and it's one that I've second-guessed myself on almost daily.
We're talking tonight with the uncompromising conservative Dick Harmy, former majority leader in the House of Representatives, about American policy and politics today. His new book is Armies, Axioms, 40 Hard-Earned Truths from Politics, Faith, and Life. What do you make of the voice to the right of George W. Bush? Are you ready for pearls of wisdom from Dick Harmy? And are there lessons for George W. Bush here, for Howard Dean here? For you, we're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Dick Harmy, please stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with the uncompromising conservative, Dick Armey of Texas, former majority leader in the House, about American policy and politics today. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Do you run toward or away from the Dick Armey view of the world? Dick Armey says macho hurts. It's one of his 40 axioms. What's the macho factor now in Iraq? And what about Dick Armey's other observation? Do liberals love feelings too much? Do conservatives love facts too much? Does the question make you mad? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Dick Armey, there's a lot I want to talk about with you tonight, but it might be most interesting, given what a kind of arch enemy you were of the liberals and the Democrats while you were in Congress, about your kind of fundamental analysis of American liberalism and conservatism. Let me see. I'm not sure which axiom this one comes under, but you've got a long discussion of where you think the kind of motivations of each of these parties fundamentally come from. I wish you'd discuss it with us. You talk about Lyndon Johnson's guile, the Kennedy style, liberals looking to feeling, Republicans looking, or conservatives looking to facts. Walk us into your view of the light and dark of Dick Armey's view of the world, the liberals and conservatives.
Yeah, well, first of all, let me just say I've studied on this for a lot of years, even years before I became involved in politics directly and ran for office. Generally speaking, liberals are for big government and essentially want to enjoy the privilege of spending other people's money. They have very little confidence in people, have very high confidence in the elite. My own view is liberals are not guilty of much deep thinking, very superficial stuff, very, very much on the cutting edge of faddish thinking, but not very good at deep thinking. And, of course, this irritates a lot of people when I say that, but the fact is I just don't think they're very bright people.
This comes under Armey's axiom number 9, which is, as you have it, the politics of greed is wrapped in the language of love. And according to the Armey view of history in the world, you say Lyndon Johnson figured this out, but he wasn't the right character to really put it into full play. He was too much the good old boy, the backroom politician image, the big beefy Texan. You say it took the Kennedy clan to kind of find the epitome of this style. What do you mean by that?
Well, Lyndon Johnson didn't have much style, you know. Jack Kennedy did. In order to feign altruism while you're, you know, feathering your own nest with other people's money and making yourself famous, being to get yourself considered to be the man of great charity with other while you're spending other people's money, you have to have a certain amount of style. And Elan. Lyndon Johnson, frankly, was just a very clumsy guy, and he did not have the admiration and the respect of the Eastern establishment. They thought of him as a bit of a rube, so he couldn't pull it off, although I think it was Lyndon Johnson who figured it out. I say, for example, I don't know that Roosevelt, who actually was the first person to really come up with the great cornerstone program of the politics of greed wrapped in a language of love, Social Security, I don't think he was actually guilty of, what should I say, premeditated self-interested politics. He thought he was solving a serious problem, I think. Lyndon Johnson...
And do you agree he was solving a serious problem during the Depression?
Well, I agree that he thought he was. That is not, obviously not the solution. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here today facing insolvency.
And you really believe that Lyndon Johnson's War on Poverty and Great Society was all kind of a cynical exploitation just for a political gain?
Yes, I really do. I mean... I know it sounds very harsh, and you know I'm sorry for that. I've thought about it for a long way. Obviously, as you know, given the double standard of tolerance, none for conservatives, much for liberals, this is not something that I would say very casually unless I was firmly convinced that I was correct in my observation.
But where does you say so? You say liberals, it's all about feeling. Republicans, it's about fact. Or conservatives about fact, but where's the place for idealism? Where's the place for progress in that
well,
view of the world?
I think I'm an idealist. I think I'm a very deep-seated idealist.
But when people, you're saying when politicians try to bring, if you're willing to concede this, when they try to bring love or concern or care into the political equation of the United States, that they're cynics, they're demagogues.
No, I didn't say that.
Okay.
When they do it for self-serving, short-sighted purposes, and they know they've created a program that is a policy disaster in the long run, and they embrace it nevertheless because it is a political success in the short run, then I say they're not doing a service for the nation or for their constituents that they on behalf of whom they have their great pretensions.
And you're ready to tar 20, 30, 40, 50 years of Democratic politics with that. And on the other side, you've got a kind of free market solution that you're proposing, a flat tax, no minimum wage, small government.
Yes, I am. And quite frankly, I start with the observation that, as I say, nobody spends somebody else's money as wisely as they spend their own. I think politics ought to begin with things like respect. There's very little respect for real people in the real world born out of big government liberalism. The whole presumption is that they either must be cared for because they're incompetent or regulated because they're untrustworthy. I think that's an enormous amount of audacity on the part of the proponents of big government, and certainly a lack of respect for real people in their real lives.
Let me ask you about the 90s, Dick Harmey, when the markets were in 20th century terms quite ascendant, and then we saw this meltdown, the stock market collapse, corporate scandals, Enron and all the rest, investment bank scandals, mutual fund scandals. How do you process that? What do you make of that? Does it give you second thoughts about an untrammeled market or something else?
No, it does give me some second thoughts, and I've studied on this. You know, the market punishes immorality. Governments usually, if there's a reward structure for immorality, it'll probably more often be found in public policy than markets.
But they punish immorality sometimes in a very delayed fashion. I mean, a lot of people can be hurt before the punishment comes around.
Yeah, one of our problems is we don't like with the delay, and I can understand that. I appreciate that. But the fact of the matter is you have aberrant behavior and always will have, whether it be in the private sector or in the public sector. And, many of us believe that in the final analysis, people who are perpetrators will be discovered. If you can master the art of perpetrator as victim in a way as, for example, Bill Clinton was so capable of doing, then, in fact, you can get away with it. The fact of the matter is harder to fool markets that are the, informed actions of real people acting in their own self-interest than it is to fool people in government whose judgment is always tempered by what is politically convenient for me at the moment. Quite frankly, this is one of the, going back to the axiom that politics sooner or later makes a horse's rear out of anybody. If you practice politics, you're going to compromise your thinking. You have to be very careful on that.
Dick Harmey, you're sounding very measured in retirement, though your axioms have still got a lot of spit and vinegar in them, the phrase used for Colin Powell today after his surgery. But, you know, you say if you're going to go ugly early, never let your face show how bad they're kicking your rear. I mean, you're right in there, and a lot of them are very tough on the Democrats. You just said that politics ought to begin with respect. When you were House Majority Leader, that was not exactly your reputation, at least in many parts of Capitol Hill. You were seen as kind of an on-the-floor gunslinger, not afraid to talk trash in the process of politics. What about respect in that arena?
Well, I think I gave a lot more respect than I ever got credit for, and I always regret that. Remember that there's also the chapter, Tattoos Last Forever.
Once a reputation is gained, you've got it.
If you talk to the rank-and-file Democrat members of the House of Representatives during the 8 years I was majority leader, they will tell you that I was frequently and generously helpful to them when they had legislative efforts that they wanted considered on the floor, more so than in many cases. In fact, I had one Democrat member tell me that I actually did more to help him than Dick Gephardt did. Now, that's largely because I was in a position as majority leader to do things for members that Dick Gephardt couldn't. But it was also the fact of the matter, I was attentive to the needs of members and considerate of them, whether they were Republican or Democrat.
Still, the tattoo is there.
Didn't make very good stories in the press.
Well, maybe not. And the tattoo, as you say, tattoos last forever. The Democrats set you off. Martin Frost and Nita Lowey saying, it has become clear that the House will become a more civil and decent institution the day Dick Armey retires. That's not exactly a fun arrow to take in your back on the way out.
No, it wasn't a very fun thing to take. But, you know, that maybe you go back to the chapter. Your worst enemies are your best friends. That was their job. When I'm the majority leader, it is their job to be critical and unkind to me. That never bothered me. I always understood that was their role.
And maybe you gave as good as you took. Dick Armey, we've got a lot of callers who want to join you tonight. Let me turn to them if we may. Dan's calling from New York City. Hi, Dan. You're on the air.
Yes. How are you? I'd be interested to know what Mr. Armey makes of the rampant incivility in today's politics, which to my eyes has increased exponentially since Mr. Armey and Mr. Gingrich took over Congress in 1994.
Well, it has. And if you don't mind my telling you, I've studied on this a great deal. It starts with the Democrats. And if you go back and check, read the record. Go read the congressional record. Charlie Rangel, and I love Charlie Rangel, but Charlie Rangel, sitting in the committee room calling Bill Archer a Nazi. No Republican would ever dare to have said a thing like that about a Democrat at any time. What happened was for 40 years, the Democrats ran the House, and everybody thought that they would run the House forever, including and especially themselves. Then when the Republicans took over the majority, they didn't like it very much. And the fact of the matter is the rampant incivility we have had in the House of Representatives since the Republicans took over the majority has always begun on the Democrat side of the aisle. Now, that you won't find it reported that way.
Always begun. That's a pretty broad, sweeping statement, Dick Armey.
Well, let me say, with very few exceptions, I can think of a few places where Republicans acted like dang fools. I saw it happen the way we now
excuse me?
But the fact of the matter is the incivility was more frequently practice on the other side of the aisle than it was on the Republican side of the aisle.
Dan, in New York, how do you see that?
Well, I don't agree with Mr. Armey at all, and I would focus his attention on Congress's incivility towards President Clinton. When the Democrats controlled Congress, you never saw such incivility towards the president, towards President Reagan, for example, or towards President Nixon, or towards other polarizing Republican presidents. You never saw congressional incivility against them in the degree that you saw from the Republican Congress to President Clinton.
Dick Armey, wasn't it you who called across the aisle in Congress that he's not our president, he's your president? Weren't those your words to the Democrats?
Well,
didn't that break precedent?
Yeah, that was an unfortunate time when I took their bait. I had listened to you for about 40 minutes. I had listened to Democrats saying that everything we had to say and do was an attack on their president. I took their bait and responded in kind, and I've taken my criticism for having done that. That happens every now and then. But the fact of the matter is, Bill Clinton got away with more than anybody I ever saw in the White House, and I don't know how anybody in the world could dispute that.
I mean, in terms of throwing dirt.
I remember watching special orders on the House by Henry B. Gonzalez virtually every night when the House went out. Session, Henry B. Gonzalez went to the floor and gave a special order and called for the impeachment of Ronald Reagan. It happened just virtually every night. And again, I'm saying this is in the record. You don't have to take my word for it. Go back and look up Henry B. Gonzalez's special orders and see how many special orders he devoted to his demands that Reagan be impeached.
Sounds like Dan sees it another way, but we've got your view, Dick Armey. Jennifer's calling from Richland Center, Wisconsin. Hi, Jennifer. You're on the air.
Hi there. Thank you, Congressman. It's an absolute pleasure to hear your voice again. I worked on the Hill in the 90s, and I spent a lot of time listening to you then. My question is this. After the 94 elections, I know that the Republicans worked very hard to manage some balanced budgets, and I think that we eventually got there. How do you view the new deficit spending or deficit budgets that are coming, you know, at the hands of the Republicans. We've got an $87 billion price tag on this Iraqi affair and a $400 billion Medicare bill that just got passed. What do you think about that?
Jennifer, it's a hot question. Thanks for giving it to us. Dick Armey.
It is a hot question. And, of course, there are many of us conservatives that are alarmed by these budgets. We felt we had established a good discipline and regimen of budget restraint up until the fateful attack on the Twin Towers. Then, of course, everybody seemed to be in a position where they had to agree that, you know, money can be no object when it comes to the nation's security and so forth. So with respect to the war against terrorism, national security issues, everybody conceded less, what should I say, devotion to balanced budgets and so forth. I liken this to a virus that got in the process, and now, of course, it's infected the whole budget process. To a large extent, the big spenders, you know, exploited that. But
the big spenders this time include Republicans.
Yes, there have always been big spending Republicans. It's just that we working very hard. We controlled the big spenders for a while. We have not done it well since 9/11. And I think it's become a matter of serious unrest in what is known in the vernacular as the Republican base. It seems to me people who would seek re-election to Congress as a Republican need to be a little attentive to what is the impatience, the concern, and in many cases, anger.
How much of that do you lay at the feet of George W. Bush, Dick Armey? Is he being responsible financial terms, fiscal terms?
I think he has just gone through a period of time where he's been particularly focused on the war against terrorism, the war in Iraq, and so forth.
But you know, these budgets are full of many, many, many dollars of spending that have nothing to do with the war in Iraq.
Well, yeah, that's right. But a great deal of that most of it originates in the House. The president, I think, has been a little bit reluctant within these circumstances to take on the big spenders in Washington. I hear it so often on hustings, he hasn't vetoed a single bill. He proposed a fairly decent budget, and then he watches Congress let it get out of control on him. The problem is he's the one in center stage, so he's the one that's going to get the tomatoes when the people get angry about it. And I think he needs to be aware of that.
Another axiom from Dick Armey's new book, Armey's Axioms, 40 Hard-Earned Truths from Politics, Faith, and Life. We're talking tonight with the uncompromising conservative, Dick Armey, former majority leader in the House. You can join the conversation. What do you make of the voice to the right of George W. Bush? Do you run toward or away from the Dick Armey view of the world? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We'll be right back with Dick Armey. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with the uncompromising conservative, Dick Armey, former majority leader in the House. You can join the conversation. Are you ready for pearls of wisdom from Dick Armey? His new book is Armey's Axioms. Are you ready to pick it up? Are you ready to read? Do liberals love feelings too much? Do conservatives love facts too much? Does the question make you mad? Are you ready to abolish the minimum wage, embrace the flat tax with Dick Armey, or to stick Dick Armey in Al Gore's lockbox? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Ryan's calling from Boston. Hi, Ryan. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just have a question for Dick Armey. I mean, I was it's a pleasure to talk to you. I was raised very conservatively, and I really believed in the market. You know, hard work would lead to success. I, you know, believed that between supply and demand, there was an invisible hand that would reward the hardworking. And then I went to school and learned things that I had never thought about before, such as, for example, education is based on property tax, and that some people didn't even have books while others had computers, and I started to view things a little bit differently. And I know that I work really hard, and I don't have health insurance, for example, and we're one of the only nations in this world, and we're the wealthiest, who doesn't have a universal health care system. I have college debt, and I went through the public system. And in my, I believe I work really hard. I'm at work now. I work like 10-hour days for the financial industry. And I'm wondering what his response to something like that would be.
So you're saying your kind of faith in the underlying precepts of the conservative view has run into some reality checks?
Has run into some reality checks. I just find it that listening to how you say that intelligence and just how conservatives are basically really intelligent and
fact-driven. They've got the reality picture. Democrats are dreaming.
The reality picture, right, and Democrats run on feelings. I sort of see it as the opposite. I see it as conservatives who have this almost fundamental faith in this supply-demand system with this benevolent, invisible hand that rewards people.
And you're not sure it's always working. Dick Armey, pick that up.
Well, let's work on that. First of all, I taught economics for 20 years in the university. And I often had students raise this same concern. One of the first things I would challenge the students is think it through for yourself. Take a look at all the things in your life that make you happy, that give you comfort, give you a sense of safety and security and so forth, and tell me where did it come from, the public sector or the private sector. Then take a look at all the things that you're in your life that aren't working properly, that don't give you the sense of security. You don't feel like it's as effective as it should be. And tell me, does it come from the public sector or the private sector? The fact of the matter is, most of the things that this young man enjoys in life is something that has been provided in the private sector, probably from minerals mined hundreds of thousands miles away, refined in another part of the world, shipped privately and through commercial sources.
But Dick Armey, I hear Ryan looking at the world and saying he sees inequities there that the market hasn't solved. Just start with education. If you don't get an equal education, how are you going to take advantage equally of opportunities that are out there?
First
that seems
all,
like a reasonable concern, doesn't it?
First of all, you don't get equal educations, and to a great extent, the bias that comes from the in the universities matters a whole lot. If you come from Harvard or Yale, you probably got a leg up in the marketplace when you go to looking for a job.
But he's starting way down from Harvard and Yale. He's starting at elementary primary school, where people have different tax bases in rich towns and poor towns.
Right.
Is that fair? Is there not a place for government to try and help people have a kind of a fair push off in life?
There is, in fact, an opportunity. By the way, this is public education. I happen to be a big proponent of public education, and I think the caller would agree with me. It is disgraceful for a nation that's as wealthy as this nation to have anything less than the best public education in the world. And yet, when you conduct school financing on a more localized basis, born out of property taxes, you have, as it were, rich school districts and poor school districts. You also have a great deal of mobility on the part of wealthy people. This is why so many of us advocate that people from lower-income families be given government scholarships to take their children to a school that is more performing on behalf of their children.
Yeah, that's charter schools, and that's kind of out of the public school system. I mean, Ryan's raising the thing. Ryan's saying maybe conservatives are more bound up in feelings here than they think, in ideology than they think when they throw the illusion brick at Democrats.
No, the problem is the people who are responsible for public education have defaulted on their responsibilities and pretty well allowed the large teachers' unions to take over the management of the schools.
Ryan, is Dick Armey bringing you around here?
Education such as tenure and so forth that are counterproductive to effective, efficient education of young people.
Ryan,
for example, advocating merit pay when I was at the university, and having two-thirds of the faculty opposed to merit pay. There's only one logical reason why anybody would oppose merit pay.
And still, it's a big, bright line you're drawing or would like to draw, Dick Armey, between two views here. Ryan, are you persuaded?
Not in particular. I mean, I think that the public school system worked really well for me. I know, I mean, other people who it hasn't worked for, and I've seen cuts in the public school system that have, more so than I believe the teacher unions, dismantled the public school system. But what I'd like to do is turn the discussion to what Dick had said about minerals being extracted from the earth and benefiting me somehow. Well, I can see that to a point, but moreover, what I'm struck by is the idea that what you are doing is recognizing that wealth comes from labor. And I'm wondering what Dick would have to say to all those people out there who worked really hard in the industrial sector that lost their jobs to countries where there aren't human rights or environmental legislations.
Dick Armey.
Well, let me just say, first of all, the first thing you have to remember, the first best beneficiary of capital equipment is the labor that has the privilege of working with it.
Well, if they have decent pay and decent working conditions.
Your pay can never be higher than your productivity. It's the old, it's a truism.
But it can be lower.
It can be lower, but in a competitive world, it will not be lower. But the fact of the matter is, your productivity goes up, your pay can go up. And if people save and accumulate capital and you innovate technology, by the way, which is working harder instead of smarter, through capital equipment, then you give poor people a better chance to make a better living. The fact of the matter is, the creativity, the savings, the investment of the wealthy is what has provided better livelihoods for the poor throughout the history of the world. It can, as far back as you want, as you can go.
Ryan, the economics professor is going to stand pat on his rock here, but we thank you for your questions tonight. Peter's calling from Exeter, New Hampshire. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
I'd like to say
that I don't know whether 12 generations as a New Englander makes me qualified as, say, Mr. Armey certainly has, with my opinion, can be call himself a New Englander for a lot of his thoughts and feelings about government.
On what front in particular? On his flinty conservative realism, Peter?
Well, I would say that would be good, but also less of a reliance on government and more on not only personal but community respect. And I'm wondering if he has noticed a trend that seems to be exhibited here in New England lately about the use of eminent domain to, I know that that's somewhat common, particularly in the western states, especially the western plain states, but...
Is somebody building a road through your family estate, Peter, or what's got it on your mind?
Actually, there's been an expansion of the local so-called wildlife refuge in Long Island Sound to take over an island called Calf Island, and while it's been in private hands for many years and financed and supported by the private sector, it's just an example of what's going on. There was also an example in New London, Connecticut, where eminent domain was used to start a hotel complex.
Let us pick it up. Dick Armey, do you see property rights being eroded?
Well, yes, I do. Eminent domain is one of these great ideas, quite frankly. When used responsibly, it can be a great benefit to the community and has been so historically. As is always the case with government, it isn't that it is or it is not that is bad. It is that it is too much or too little or too responsibly used or irresponsibly used. And what has happened now is eminent domain is being exercised at such an egregious level over such a wide area of interest that it has been corrupted and results in many, many people feeling, and justifiably feeling, that their property is being taken from them or their use of their property is being restricted for no justifiable cause. So eminent domain is a decent tool of government when used properly and responsibly. The biggest thing I see is a pattern of usage that is excessive and abusive, and that, of course, is what gives you the backlash.
So hold on to those property rights. Eric is calling from Taunton, Massachusetts. Hi, Eric. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Yeah.
I like the analysis as it is, the financial analysis between the liberals and the conservatives, how people that are spending their own money make better decisions. And I wanted to ask Dick about applying that same standard to social issues in terms of making a distinction between conservatives and liberals in terms of, oh, any social issue, gay marriage, gambling, prostitution.
Give us an example. How would you apply that kind of thinking, Eric?
Well, for example.
He probably knows where I'm going, but for example, with gay marriage in terms of private sector versus public sector, a lot of people are unhappy because they can't, say, gamble, or they can't get a prostitute, or they can't take certain drugs because the public sector is stopping them from doing that.
And are you saying you'd rather give the markets a shot at regulating that behavior?
I'd like to see people be able to decide for themselves, just like they do with their money, or should be able to do with their money, the actually more important decisions in their personal lives that I think are even more important than how they spend their money, which is how they spend their life, I guess you would say.
Let's get to it. Dick Armey, what about tossing off government-imposed morality?
And that is a problem, isn't it? I would probably go to a cocktail party tonight, or maybe I would rather go to a garden party and just please myself.
Maybe.
But let's say I go to a garden party. I would have probably a sociology professor who would argue with me in the same breath, in the same sentence. The government ought to stay out of gay marriage, and it ought to stay out of abortion, and it ought to enforce laws against hate crimes. So what happens is you have voices on the right and on the left that plead for a government enforcement of a code of morality, ethics, proper conduct, and so forth. And you have, for example, I might have a history professor who would say, we got to put an end to all these Second Amendment rights that are running rampant around the country while we preserve the First Amendment. So that the fact of the matter is government will and always has represented some code of morality, and there are some disputes.
But let's keep it.
I would say to the left, you give up your desire for hate crimes and get the government out of that, maybe we can both become civil libertarians, and I'll give up my interest in other forms of government.
Maybe, but we won't hold our breath. Dick Armey, we've just got a minute left. I want to ask you about the presidential elections coming up. Howard Dean, axiom 11 in your book is, a little man can whip a big man every time if he's in the right and keeps on a-coming. I don't know who the little and big man is in this contest, but what do you think of the Democrats' prospects, of Howard Dean's prospects, if he's the one?
Well, see, that axiom wouldn't apply to Howard Dean because the axiom says if he's in the right, it keeps on going, but be that as it may. I think Howard Dean will get the nomination from the Democrats. The reason I believe he will is that he is the most liberal of the candidates, and the Democrats will only nominate a person who pretends to be conservative. They don't want to get stuck like they did with Jimmy Carter and get one who really is. But they don't really have anybody out there in this campaign field that's pretending to be conservative.
And George Bush, any problems with his Republican base?
I think if he doesn't pay attention to this budget process, he could have serious problems with his base. I travel across the country quite a bit, and I see a lot of very disgruntled conservatives that are worried about the free spending practices of this the government as we see it today. And, of course, they put that at the president's feet.
And still, we see where Dick Armey is finally coming down. Dick Armey, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Well, thanks for having me.
Dick Armey's new book is Armey's Axioms, 40 Hard-Earned Truths from Politics, Faith, and Life. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Mm-hmm.